Welcome to Sabbath School once again. This is a time of year when a lot of people are coming and going and a lot of people are involved in graduations and so forth, but the faithful are still here. So let's jump into it. Now, let me just warn you in advance that we're going to do something a little different that we haven't tried before this morning. We're going to cover two Sabbath School lessons during this hour because we want to save the next hour for covering material that we really need to do as well. So we've got two time crunches here. So we're going to cover lesson four and lesson five in Old Testament couples, talking about Jacob and Rachel and then about Moses and Zipporah. So get your roller skates on and let's go. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, we come seeking your special guidance, the care of your Holy Spirit, the enlightenment of the Spirit as we study these stories from Old Testament times. We know so little, really, of the lives of these people, but from the little which we do know, we believe there are lessons we may learn, and so may it be true of us. This morning is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Jacob and Rachel. As I remember it, there were more people involved than just Rachel, right? And so we have the challenge of dealing with two regular wives and two subordinate wives, two concubines, some would have called them surrogate mothers, maybe, as it would be a proper term. I don't know, possibly. But here we go now. Why do you think Jacob, and one of the big emphases in the lesson study guide for this lesson is that Jacob really loved Rachel. And so the question is, you know, love is a big thing in our world. We've almost come to worship it as if it were some kind of magic. And that when people get married, they're supposed to get married because they really love each other. My friends in other parts of the world will tell you, you know, you people have it backwards. You take a pot that's boiling hot and you put it on a cold stove and it gradually gets colder. And we, our parents, arrange our marriages and we get together and maybe we meet our bride or our husband for the first time on the day we get married, and we put a cold pot on a hot stove and it gradually gets hotter. So I don't know. What about this? What do you think what it was about Rachel that made Jacob really love her? Let's start off with that simple question. You think she was especially good looking? Was that the main reason? Anyway, we got here. Hold on a second. Microphone's coming. We got Van over here, and I think we got Lorna. Were you going to say something too? Hold on a second. No.
Okay.
There we go.
Who knows what this thing is all about? It seems like love is a big deal in the entire universe, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, you see people together, and there's a certain what we call chemistry between people. Mm-hmm. And you can't quite figure out exactly what it is, but it is there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eHarmony thinks they've got figured out. Mm-hmm. I wonder.
Okay. Lorna, we got a mic over on this side. Coming down.
No, from the translations, was Rachel very beautiful? Did she have beautiful eyes? Or can that be translated different ways?
Well, you know, there's a comment about Leah that she had something unusual about her eyes. Some translators have put that she had very beautiful eyes. I know that implies that that was the best thing about her. Others suggest that there was something wrong with her eyes. They're not sure how to translate that. Now, that's regarding Leah. But as far as I know, there's nothing nothing about Rachel, except that she apparently was beautiful, and Jacob loved her. And we're trying to figure out why. Yes. Kelly. Oh, go ahead.
It seems to me in that part of the world, rather, and in that time, it's not unlike Muslim world today. Women were more or less chattels, but she seemed to be very considerate and thoughtful, particularly when the servant came to the same well that she was at, and she drew water and offered it to him. She didn't really have to do that. Uh-huh. She probably, if she had been true to form, stepped back while he helped himself, but she must have had a way of getting along with people.
Yeah, okay. John.
Well, I'm thinking that maybe Jacob could never believe his eyes after he did the deal with Esau and his father. And so I think he must have had a chemical reaction rather than with Rachel, rather than something he saw with his eyes. He couldn't believe his eyes anymore.
Okay. Well, let's say one thing for sure, and this may not be what you were initially thinking, but I think it's an important point for us to think about. Something is of value to you almost in direct proportion to what it costs you. In effect, Jacob ended up working 14 years for this Rachel. He had three other wives who were sort of forced on him. But Rachel, he worked 14 years for. Maybe that's what made her seem very special in his eyes. It's just a possibility. And in this respect, of course, following the story on very quickly, after working for 7 years and being so excited on his wedding day, he is just ecstatic, and he marries this woman who, of course, is wearing a veil and goes through the ceremony. And how that all happened, I'm not quite sure, but it seems to imply that he woke up the next morning and discovered it's the wrong woman. Now, the first question in respect to that I would like you to think about and answer for me is, who was complicit in this deception? Was it Laban only? Was it Laban and Leah? Did Leah always have a crush on Jacob all the years he'd been there and had hoped that Jacob would marry her instead of Rachel? Or do you think it was Laban and Leah and Rachel all who thought this was a good idea? Wally.
If I'm not mistaken, I understand Laban mentioned that the oldest had to be married first.
Yeah.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
But would not Jacob know about that if that were actually the case?
You would have thought so. And that raises the question that I think the obvious question, did either one of these young women have any other suitors? Did Jacob have any competition? Yeah, Kelly.
I'm wondering, considering what Jacob and his mother did to Esau, whether this was an indirect way of God teaching him some lessons. This was what goes around comes around.
I see. Well, what do you think, and someday I think we'll get to see this, I hope so, even though it might be at his expense, I don't know. What do you think he said the next morning, first to Leah, and then to Laban, and maybe eventually to Rachel? Do you think Laban somehow or other tricked Rachel and hid her away so she couldn't have anything to say about all this? I mean, when was the last time Jacob saw her before what he thought was going to be their wedding day? Yes, Donna.
Somebody's already mentioned that these were basically chattel.
Yeah.
So it was probably Laban's decision whether they agreed or disagreed was probably not important. Mm-hmm. And Jacob would have known that this was not their decision. Mm-hmm. It's never brought up that Jacob scolded Rachel or Leah.
No. Did Jacob call his lawyer?
He would have liked to have. But it just was, you know, it was Laban's decision. It seems like that was the most powerful factor. And he could kill them or he could do this with them. And this is what he chose to do with them. And Rachel, if she were hidden away or if she were not, she didn't have an option of doing something differently, I don't think. And I don't think Leah did either.
Well, you know, women can be chattel. They can also have very clever ways of getting what they want. You know, if Rachel really didn't want this, didn't want to have anything to do with this, and she knew about it any length of time in advance, do you don't think she could have slipped a hint to Jacob? I mean, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying, you know, there are ways to get around some of these things. Man.
Well, she had, I suppose, the potential to abduct her sister and hide her away and hide under the veil herself.
Yeah. Yeah, why not? Okay. So, I mean, think about this. Do you think that these two girls just, Laban just had them absolutely under his control and he said, Rachel, you go there and Leah, you go there, and they didn't have any questions? I mean, that's just the way things are.
Tell me more about veils. Today in the Muslim world and back there in Jacob's time, what is the purpose of a veil? Why do they veil their women?
And I ought to let someone speak who has more authority than I do, but it's my understanding from what I understand of the current culture and of the old times is that the idea, basically, that a beautiful woman is only supposed to be seen by her husband. So, the rest of the time she wears a veil. She doesn't have to wear a veil at home if only her husband is around. So, yes.
How did he know that Rachel was beautiful and Leah had tender eyes at the beginning if they were veiled then? Was it a veil that they just wore on the day of their wedding?
Well, apparently she must have been wearing some kind of veil on the day of her wedding. And the fact that, I mean, the fact that Jacob thought she was beautiful when he met her at the well at the beginning suggests to me that there was more exposed than a bunch of cloth.
And if I were Jacob, I wished I had peeked under the veil the day of the wedding.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. Well, on that morning, all of a sudden now Jacob discovers he's married to Leah. Okay, how many options did he have? Kelly, I'm sorry, you wanted to say something.
I was just going to comment on what what you just said about the women then is, and Muslims today, is about half of it. If you look at the Shia law today, if a woman gets raped, it's never the man's fault. They wanted the women covered up for more than just the husband, and it's interesting to note, even today, men are no angels. You can cover them from head to foot, but it's, you know, what's going to happen will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well,
why didn't Jacob recognize, unless both these women had similar figures and height, something should have shown him.
Exactly, and did she not say a single word? I mean, you know, Jacob should have been aware of people wearing sheep's clothing. He'd been through this before. You know, if you stop and think about this, it should raise a lot of questions in your mind, you know? He'd been pretty good at that himself, Brian.
Rachel was fully complicit in this.
Okay.
And she really can't get married before her older sister. So that, you know, that night the switch in the tent took place probably at her... And Rachel's idea, you know,
and
it was a part of it, but...
And there's always the possibility that Rachel was there during the whole ceremony, and all of a sudden, just the last minute, there's a switch. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know how this was done. I have no idea. I'm just saying those are possibilities. But this is the question now. Jacob wakes up, find out he's in bed with the wrong woman. What are his choices? Come on, two or three choices have to be obvious. What are they? Speak up, somebody. Ryan. Okay, go.
First, he has to examine himself for a backbone, which apparently he doesn't have, so his choices are limited from there.
Well, now, hold on. Before you go too far with that, this guy is working. He's worked 7 years. He basically owns nothing. Okay, he has no bargaining chips. He's there. He's given his 7 years. The 7 years are gone. Okay, now, what does he have to bargain with?
Not his backbone, that's for sure. I mean, this is all conditioned, you know, with the whole thing from Esau and Isaac. I mean, it started that way. He came into the situation, you know, less than forthright and kind of on his knees, and he's back there again, you know, can I have another 7 years?
Okay. Kelly?
It seems to me he had three or four immediate options when he was fully awake and realized. He could have looked at her and said, well, I want better, but she's okay. Or he could have kicked her out. He could have gone to Laban and said, I'm taking Rachel. If you give me any trouble, I'll stick something in your ribs. Period.
Yeah.
He was a younger man. He may not have had a lot, but he certainly had virility over the old man.
And that's not all. There was another option. He could have said, I'm out of here. He didn't have to stick around with a wife or without wife. Ryan.
Well, he didn't really have the option to leave. I mean, he's still fearful of Esau. Had he left, he would have put himself back into the predicament he was in before.
He got over that a little bit later.
Well, that was difficult after he wrestled with God, sure. But, I mean,
well, God could arrange a wrestling match at any time.
Well, but it wasn't until... Anyway, I understand that. Yeah, I think, you know, to have divorced Leo would have upset Rachel even more. And you're right, he had no money, and the community obviously was probably on Laban's side, and Laban utilized the situation, and God punished him for it.
Well, that's one of the questions. Do you think the community would have been on Jacob's side or Laban's side in this argument? I mean, the people at Haran, were they rah, rah, rah Laban on this case, or were they on Jacob's side?
Well,
John.
To answer that question, I have another question, too. I think the community would have been on Laban's side. Mm-hmm. I think that was probably a well-entrenched custom. I mean, in those days, love was not the big thing in getting married. It was, it was wealth and social position.
But hold on, I'm going to turn your question around on you, because if that's the case, if we're saying this whole thing was arranged by Laban, why hadn't he arranged for somebody else to marry Leah? I mean, he had gotten much, much, much more wealthy since Jacob showed up on the scene. Now he's a very wealthy man. Why hasn't he arranged for a wedding for his oldest daughter?
It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
But I have another question. Okay. You're asking what should Jacob do when he wakes up with a different woman in bed. I wonder if he was thinking at all that he was the son of Isaac and the son of Abraham, and just what his position is in the eyes of God, who has made these promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and how does Leah fit in, and how would Rachel fit in? What's the problem here? What's he going to do?
Yeah.
And by the way, which of them, Leah or Rachel, is the forebear of the Christ?
Leah.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Wally?
You know, one thing that I noticed is that it seemed like everything that he did was blessed, and I think Laban knew that. Mm-hmm. I think Laban was trying to be as deceiving as he can to keep him there as long as possible.
Absolutely.
I think personally he's the one that influenced this more than anything. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me, because even when Laban was young, he was the first one to run out to the well and meet the servant, when he came down to try to find a wife for, at that time, for, I can't think Rebecca. Of the name, for, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, it seemed like he was interested in wealth and nothing but wealth.
Here's another question. I'm thinking of possibilities here. Why didn't Jacob wire home for some extra money back when they said, hey, you got to pay your dowry? He said, okay, I got a man back home. My folks back home, they got plenty of money. I mean, if Abraham could send a servant with all camel loads of whatever down to get a wife for his son, why didn't Jacob say, look, I've got the birthright. I'm supposed to have lots of children. You promised me, okay, help me out here. Send a dowry down here. I'll marry the wife. I'll get on with having the children. This is part of my inheritance. I mean, I can't be the only one who ever thought of these things. Go ahead.
Well, he couldn't do that because he'd lost all the hair off of his arms and it kept him going to that point.
Yeah, I don't think that's...
Deception is a part of this whole thing. How are you going to write home to someone that you bowled over with lies and...
Well, but hold on. Hold on, Brian. You remember that Isaac had stood there. Maybe he was deceived, but he blessed this son of his, and he blessed him with many children. Okay, now why can't he help him out? If he's blessed with many children...
He was blessed, but when he blessed him, he was blind as a bat. I mean, at this point, his love was still with Esau because Esau fetched him venison. I mean, he didn't have those kind of feelings for Jacob.
Well,
that was
but
his wife's kid.
Esau had now three wives, and they weren't happy with any of them. So why couldn't they go with the one they thought they might possibly have a chance of getting some... you know, favorite sons out of.
It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. I think
Van.
It's still with Esau.
Did it ever occur to him to run off to Vegas and to elope and take...
Why not?
Take his choice and run?
All that wealth left behind.
See, there's another possibility. Jerry. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kelly. You were first, I guess.
I'm just going to say... I'm wondering whether Jacob was beginning to learn some valuable lessons. He'd already gotten himself in a pile of trouble back home. Did he want to push his luck this far and risk it again?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jerry.
I'm not sure that I've ever heard these stories, we are referring to several here, but the primary one we're focused on being, of course, Jacob, but I'm not sure we've used any of them as examples of family life, ideal family life, our marriage.
Well, but it says he loved her. I mean, how many stories do we have in the Bible where it says the husband really loved the wife?
You've had children and teenagers and how they love this one and that one. Do you believe them? I mean, come on.
This guy wasn't a teenager. He's 47 years old or whatever.
He was acting like a teenager, just like Brian has said. But I suppose, you know, what's amazing is that God blessed the guy.
Yeah.
What does this say about God?
And maybe God stuck because the birthright has been handed to him.
I mean, it seems to me to understand that God meets people even within the dysfunctional cultural... Yeah. Situations they live and exist in, and so forth.
Amazing. Judy.
Do you believe People magazine?
I don't read People magazine. I don't even...
This is just about as good, isn't it?
Well, you don't even buy any groceries then, Ken. I don't buy
Yeah, I do. But you know, when I go to the grocery store, I go because my wife sends me. I zip in, I grab what I need, and I zip out as fast as I can. Man.
You know, there's all kinds of things here that are tripping levers in my mind. Was multiple wives the given norm at that time? Or
depends on how much money you have.
Yeah, he didn't have any. and was his faith so weak in God that he had to pursue his own interest, that he couldn't have just given up after Leah and said, okay, this is the one that God has arranged for me, and stick with that?
Okay, Norm.
You said that Jacob was a poor so-and-so, didn't have anything. When he left, he was a pretty rich character.
Yeah.
Now, are you suggesting that he acquired all that in the last 20 minutes of his stay there, or was he building wealth during this point? And might it be that he had a good thing going, and another 7 years wasn't all that bad?
Well, the what the scripture says is he worked 7 years without earning anything except his keep and a wife. And then he worked another 7 years for the same wife again. And then he started building his wealth. That's what seems to be implied. So he spent 6 years gaining all that wealth. And of course, Laban says he didn't really gain it. He stole it from him. And that was the last 6 years. That was Laban's claim. Remember, he changed his wages 10 times in 6 years because he thought Jacob was doing something funny with those sticks, remember? Well, you know, another part of... Yeah, Lorna.
Jacob may not have felt that he had any of the inherited wealth, that he had gotten the blessing from God, which is what he craved because of his dream when he left, but not the wealth, and that he had no access to that, that he didn't want it. He thought Esau would kill him if he tried to get it, so he wasn't going to send for any flocks and herds.
He wasn't asking for any huge part of this. I mean, according to their custom, he deserved 2/3 of his father's wealth. He deserved it. It was his right. All he was asking for was a dowry.
But he wouldn't, I don't think he would ask for it because he was so fearful and he had left under such a cloud.
Well,
and he believed he had God's blessing and God's blessing would go with him. But he when he met Esau, did he ask for anything?
No.
He said, no, I don't need anything. I don't want anything.
Well, if you got miles around you surrounded with camels and horses and donkeys and sheep and goats and family and soldiers and whatever, no, you don't need anything.
And he was very, very fearful.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry for him if he didn't have any more, Brian said, he didn't have any more backbone than that at that point in time. One of the things we need to remember, and we're... Like I told you, we're going to try to do two lessons this morning, so I want to sort of wrap this one up. One of the things to remember is that every one of these three generations in a row now have married women that, according to our law today, would have been against the law. Did that have anything to do with the problems we got going on here? Well, I mean, it's hard to know, but it's interesting. And the lesson toward the end suggests that we look at Genesis 6, 1 to 5. You remember that Genesis 6, 1 to 5 talks about the events and the circumstances that led to the flood. And it said, the sons of God looked at the daughters of men and saw that they were fair or beautiful. And so they took any ones that they wanted. That sounds a little bit like evolutionary theory, doesn't it? Yeah, there was a lot of polytheistic religions that took that kind of an approach. A couple of things. First of all, who were these sons of God and these daughters of men? And I, this is another story, but I just in brief, it's something that we need to review. There have been lots of theories. My favorite translation says angels came down and cohabited with women. I don't believe that for a second. Ellen White says that the sons of God were the descendants of the faithful. The daughters of men were the daughters of those who were descendants of Cain or his like, who were, you know, doing their own thing kind of thing. And this corrupted the religion and so forth. But it's... And the reason for doing all of this at this point in time, to talk about it, is, okay, you got four wives here. Did he marry them for love? Well, apparently he married Rachel because he loved her. Whatever that implies, I'm not sure we understand. He got Leah by deceit. He took on two more wives. I mean, has this become habitual? What, shouldn't he have said at that point in life, well, you know, I've got two already. That's plenty. Yeah, Kelly.
We've kind of mentioned it or on the outskirts, but he lived in an area where this was not an unknown thing, plural wives. And if your wife was barren, she could hand over one of her female servants, and he could use her as a wife.
So this would be a surrogate mother, we would call it.
Whether he should have done it is another thing, but this was not unknown in that part of the world.
So...
And to bring it a little closer to home, and don't misunderstand me, but my wife and I at times have talked, just because you end up marrying one woman and faithful to her, does that mean there's not somebody else in the world that you wouldn't have an equally successful marriage? No, there's got to be somewhere. Maybe he figured he'd make a go of it.
Yeah. Okay, John.
Well, I think we need to review Galatians about Sarah and...
Hagar
to figure out what's going on here with Jacob and his wives. One of them is going to bear the son of promise. All the rest are bystanders or whatever. No matter how many children they have.
Well, it's very interesting. I'm willing to bet that not a person in this room at the end of their lives would have picked out Judah as being the famous son. Not until Jacob finally, or Israel at that point in time, actually makes that prediction. They started to get the idea, oh, I mean, and again, we're not going to talk about Judah and his experiences. He marries a Canaanite wife. He loses her. He loses his first two oldest sons. He's got one son left. He carries on with a prostitute. He gets two more sons. I mean, you know, what's going on here?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out.
Okay. Well, one of the things that the lesson concludes with is that we would stay out of a lot of trouble if we just waited patiently for the Lord. Okay? Tell me how Jacob should have waited patiently for the Lord. Brian.
His faith should have been in God and not in his soup.
Okay. And how would that have changed this story?
If he would have waited for God to work out the whole birthright instead of playing with the soup and the hairy arms, you know, it would have come down right. He wouldn't have been on the lamb his whole life.
Okay, there's a good possibility. Wally?
Are we to be like Abram, wait until we're 100 years old?
Well, if you're going to be waiting until you're 100, you better have some good assurances from God that he's going to help you out, or you're going to be out of luck. You know, that would be my guess. Okay, well, we want to say one more thing and then we need to move on to...
If Abraham had stopped having children when he had Isaac... What would the situation in the world today be like?
I'm not sure if I... he had not married Keturah?
The six that he had...
With Keturah.
Are the ancestors of most of the Middle East.
He already had Ishmael. He was a good start.
Well, he was a good start, but his descendants would have been a lot fewer than the other. If Jacob had, as soon as Leah had her firstborn, had stopped having children, of course he had those four women that were not interested in stopping, they were interested in gaining more children. But what, think of all the conflicts that have happened between the children of promise and the children of no promise, the children of no promises.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on because I want to give a fair time to our second lesson. The second lesson that we're talking about today is about Moses and Zipporah. Now, we don't know a great deal about Zipporah, but we do know some things, and we know some things about her family, And so let's look at this for a moment. Think about Moses, first of all, and this he's the key star in this story. He was born as an Israelite slave. He grew up as an Egyptian prince. And he spent the next, after the first 40 years, he spent the next 40 years as a foreigner, a wanderer, a refugee. I mean, what kind of a deal is that? Now, in our previous lesson, and we didn't have time to talk about this, one of the conclusions was that we should not be unequally yoked with the wrong partners. Would you say that a person trained as an Egyptian prince who marries a Midianite nomad is unequally yoked? I mean, it's nice for us to use these cliche little things where they seem to fit. What happens if you use it in a story like this, Kelly?
I was going to say, not in this case, not necessarily. Yes, he was a well-educated man according to the standards of his day. The daughters described to their father that they thought he was an Egyptian, so he had a way of speaking and maybe dress. Mm-hmm. But if I remember, the Midianites, I think they wasn't that an outer province, or they were sort of cousins of Egyptians on the northeast corner of Egypt. Somewhere up in there was where they were, I think. So they weren't exactly unknown, the two nations.
Okay. What do we know about the Midianites? Because that would be one of the next big questions. What do we know about them? If I can get my Bible going here. Look at Genesis 25, verse 1. Abraham married another wife whose name was Keturah. And I read on. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuha. Midian was a descendant of Abraham. These Midianites were cousins, just like the descendants of Lot were cousins, and so forth. Now, we know that if you read on here, it'll say that Moses sent them away while they were still relatively young to the land of the east because he didn't want them to share inheritance with his son Isaac. I wonder how they felt about that. Maybe that was part of the problem of what developed later. They felt like they had been cheated. I don't know. He probably blessed them with considerable money and so forth. But these people are not strangers and foreigners. These are cousins. So now, in light of that, what language do you suppose they spoke?
Abraham's.
I think that they were speaking Hebrew, probably, or something very close to Hebrew. And if you go back in the text that we have available to it today, you'll find out that the Midianite language, what we have preserved in on stones and in tablets and so forth, is very close to Hebrew. So they're not speaking Egyptian, they're speaking Hebrew, I'm sure, or something very close to Hebrew. Okay, Van, you're next.
This idea of unequally yoked, we tend to have a picture in our mind of what that means, like you can't marry somebody of a different religion. But, you know, this is an analogy from plowing, mm-hmm, and, hooking up animals to a cart. And if you have two animals that are, quote, unequally yoked, you'll go in circles. Now, that's because they're not pulling the same, and they're not allowed to be given directions. Now, if you have a particular religion and you marry somebody else of a different religion, if you're pulling together through life, what else would God ask for? What else could there be? I mean, if there's any kind of a relationship there, there's going to be a meeting of the minds of understanding about God, you would think. Although, okay, there's ample evidence in the Bible that didn't take place. But,
okay.
On that, when they're plowing, if they're unequally yoked, they're going to make circles instead of straight rows. And that doesn't go well in wheat farming and other things that we do here in the United States. But the I think the strength they're talking about here is the strength in going toward all of God's people have been, since Abraham was called, he was traveling. And Jacob went down to somewhere else.
They're all nomads.
They're all nomads. They never get to the promised land and stay there. Mm-hmm. Abraham had to fight a famine in the very land that he was told was going to be given to him.
Abraham is a wealthy man. Does it mean the only thing he could afford was a place to bury his wife?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the only property he bought. Why?
But the unequally yoked thing is that you don't get a straight line to your destination.
It's another illustration of how we use these illustrations when they fit, but we don't like them when they don't fit. Because Jesus in Matthew 11 says, take my yoke upon you. And the implication is, okay, he's going to be in half of this yoke and you're going to be in the other half. Is that unequally yoked? You better believe it's unequally yoked. Does that mean we're going around in circles? I hope not.
Not if you have your eyes on it.
Okay, but can't you do that if you're unequally? Yes. Wally.
You know, so often I hear situations where, you know, probably here in America it's more racial differences, uh-huh, or else religious differences as to why we encourage not to marry within individuals. And when I was younger, I sat back and I questioned that. I sat back and I said, why do we do that? If we go back far enough, we're all related. Where do we draw that line? Where do we sit back and say, well, you're going to create controversy, but yet what happened with Cain and Abel? Mm-hmm. I mean, were they unequally yoked? You go from generation to generation, individual to individual. I think we really seriously have to look at this more carefully. It's so easy to sit back and say, well, you're not the same religion. I think there's some that work out quite well.
Well, our lesson here suggests that Laban was a polytheist. Not even a pagan. They even call him a pagan. I revolted against that. I absolutely disagree with that. I mean, and the reason they say that is because he seems to suggest that the God that Moses worshiped was better than some other gods. Well, I mean, what does the first commandment say? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Doesn't that recognize the existence of some other gods? I mean, I think that's an error. I mean, I'm sorry, but I couldn't agree with him on that one. What else do we know about the family of Zipporah, her father? Her father has a couple of names at least, Reuel and Jethro. The name Reuel means friend of God. Who else in the Bible is called a friend of God? Okay, Abraham was. Anybody else? Moses. But there's someone who actually had that name. Come on. I think that was difficult. Do you remember what it says in the Gospel of Luke? Let's look over there for a second. Let's see. Look at Luke 1, verse 1. Dear Theophilus, you know what Theophilus means? Friend of God. So the book of Luke and the book of Acts were written to this friend of God. Okay, so Reuel isn't all by himself in this situation.
Isn't it actually
God? Well, depends on how you put that. Lover of God, friend. Yeah, sure. Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love. It's also the being friend. We don't think, you know, how intimate do we want this love to be? You know, we got to be careful here. So, okay. Well, this father that we read about is also called Jethro. There is some hint to suggest that Jethro was maybe more of a title than a name. He apparently was also some kind of priest. Does that mean he was a pagan priest? I don't think that's implied. How do you understand that? What kind of a priest do you think he was? Anyone have any compelling thoughts on that? You've done your research carefully.
Would this be the same situation as the one that Moses paid, that Abraham
paid, his
tithe paid
to?
Tithes to? Is that, was this the same kind of a priest?
Possibly, perhaps? Yeah. Melchizedek? Yeah. Well, there were other people around at that point in time who were apparently faithful followers of what they perceived at least as the true God. So we shouldn't find that so surprising. Did Moses love Zipporah, or was this a marriage of convenience? As we just talked about Jacob loving Rachel. What do you think? Did he pick her out, or did Reuel after a while say, well, you know, you're going to stick around here. Why don't you marry my daughter? Kelly.
There must have been something going, because she stuck with him through thick and thin, right through to wandering in the desert on the way to what we call Israel, or that general area. There had to have been something more than just a grudging match.
But there was at least one important issue about which they disagreed. What's that? Circumcision. Now, you have to read between the lines here, but on that journey to back to Egypt, something really strange happens. Do you remember the story? What happened? It's about Exodus 4:31, isn't it, somewhere there? Okay, verses 24 to 26, Exodus 4. There it is up here. Let me put it right at the top of the screen there. At a camping place on the way to Egypt, the Lord met Moses and tried to kill him. Okay, this means that God wanted to kill Moses. He really tried hard, but he just couldn't do it. Right? Didn't have the power.
The name here is Yahweh. I think we shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And he wanted to kill Moses, but he couldn't. Kelly.
Well, Moses being born of what we call the children of Israel, mm-hmm. the boys had to be circumcised. And Moses wasn't too keen about it because it wasn't an Egyptian custom. She ended up circumcising the lad, and later on in Egypt, over the plagues, he ran a good risk of having his own son killed in the plagues if the kid wasn't circumcised.
Well, hold on. Now, you're corrupting things quite a bit here. First of all, the son wasn't anywhere around during the plagues. He went back home with mom. The question is, why wasn't he circumcised on the eighth day? Moses' first son was, but the second son wasn't. Why do you suppose it happened like that? And these are important things in understanding these marriages. I know there's not a great deal of detail, but let's be honest with it. What's going on here? Ellen White says the youngest son had not been circumcised. Why? You done your homework, John?
Well, it says, and so Yahweh spared Moses' life, because...
You're getting ahead of the story. I asked a specific question. Why wasn't this youngest son circumcised?
I think Zipporah wouldn't let him.
Okay, now, and I think that's very clear evidence that that's the case. And why did he circumcise the first son, but now he's leaving the second son? But she let him circumcise the first son. Now, if she didn't know what it was all about, why did she let him circumcise the first son? Yeah.
Did he have a first wife?
Moses?
And that son was the son of that wife. And he brought the son. I don't know where the son came from. It doesn't
tell us. Boy, we are getting into wild stories here. Okay. Where'd that come from? No, there's a simple explanation to this, I think. Moses, when he was first there, he has a son. He says, I'm a Hebrew. God has miraculously preserved my life. I want to be a part of the children of Israel. God's going to do something. You know, I'm going to circumcise this son. Several more years go by. They have another son. And Zipporah says, okay, nothing's happening. You haven't been called back to Egypt. You're going to be a Midianite now. We're going to treat this child as a Midianite. We're not going to circumcise him. Perfectly logical. And Moses says, well, it looks like you're right. I haven't heard anything recently from God. You know, maybe we're going to be Midianites. Maybe all that dream stuff is over. We won't bother to circumcise this child. So they didn't. Yes.
Why didn't the Midianites circumcise? They were sons of Abraham, and maybe they lost that in the generations that passed?
Well, if both the Midianites and the Israelites were accustomed to circumcision, then this child should have been circumcised no matter what. He wasn't. So I have to conclude that the Midianites didn't make it one of their customs. Because Ellen White says, at her urging, Moses agreed not to circumcise this child. Okay, so now they're on their way, and suddenly there's a crisis. Wally?
Why do we be so surprised as from generation to generation that they want to have changes? I mean, even today, our next generation wants to do things a little differently than what we think necessarily should be part of our religious activity. Why do we think it's not that way back then, that may not be the same occurrence?
As far as the Midianites are concerned and following Abraham, you mean? Yeah. Okay? So here they are, and we read the story here. It says, God tried to kill him. Then Zipporah, his wife, took a sharp stone, cut off the foreskin of her son, and touched Moses' feet with it. And there's a little asterisk there. And for those of you who are familiar with the very concrete language that the Hebrews use, feet here, or legs, is a, what's the right word? A code word, a euphemism. Euphemism is like a euphemism for his genitals. Because of the rite of circumcision, she said to Moses, you are a husband of blood to me, and so the Lord spared Moses' life. Now, how many of you have heard a sermon on that? Yeah, John, the mic's coming.
Are you going to tell us what unraveled this? You are a husband of blood to me? What does that mean?
I'm going to tell you all about this story. Just hold on a moment.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Kelly.
Now, I'm going to walk maybe on dangerous ground here. Apart from Mrs. White, do we have more definitive information? It seems to me if God wanted to kill Moses, he could have zapped him right there. There was a reason for this somewhere, or we don't have it. Are we just surmising, or is there a basic lesson to be learned here?
Okay, now here's the point at which we want to take a, see if I can get us to the right spot here. There's a very interesting statement, and you said apart from Ellen White. And the answer is, apart from Ellen White, no, we don't. And if you go, you look in commentaries, basically, they'll foam a little bit, and that's about it. They don't have anything very useful to say about this. Now, how far and to what extent Ellen White had special revelation on this subject, I don't know. I just know what she says, and I assume that it's inspired. And she gives quite a bit of detail, a surprising amount of detail. Here's the, well, I'm going to take time, you know, we've just got about 5 minutes left. Look at the bold print here, page 255 and 256 of Patriarchs and Prophets. This is Ellen White. Moses was to be placed in a position of great peril. His life could be preserved only through the protection of holy angels. But while living in neglect of a known duty, he would not be secure, for he could not be shielded by the angels of God. Now, I'm going to ask you a very serious question here. before we read the next paragraph, is God a nitpicking God or not? Is God saying, you didn't circumcise your son, therefore I can't help you take the children of Israel out of Egypt? Does that sound a little bit exacting or nitpicky to you? You've been doing a lot of research, John.
No, I've been thinking a lot of foolish thoughts. I say, yes, he is nitpicking in that he wants to know where every atom and molecule in the whole universe is at all times. Mm-hmm. That's kind of nitpicking, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he doesn't let any of them stray.
But he doesn't take my life because one molecule gets out of order somewhere.
Well, I don't know about trying to kill Moses and not being able to. I think there's a translation there that needs to be examined and maybe rewritten. Because if he wanted to kill Moses, he could have killed Moses.
Okay. The rest of you? Kelly.
I was just going to say, in light of that, that does shed a little light in an earlier tunnel for a phrase of speech there. God realized that Moses, although originally trained as a military man, was impulsive. He committed murder, he lost his temper, he ran as a fugitive. And I would say, looking at that, he knew what Moses had ahead of him, and he wanted to make sure that Moses had his,
colloquialism,
his act together solidly.
Isn't that why he had to spend 40 years with the sheep? Part of it. Okay. Okay, what's going on here? Well, the reason this is relevant, read the next paragraph. In the time of trouble just before the coming of Christ, which hopefully some of us might possibly be involved in, the righteous will be preserved through the ministration of heavenly angels, but there will be no security for the transgressor of God's law. Angels cannot, notice, and up there before it says they could not, here it says they cannot protect those who are disregarding one of the divine precepts. Boy, we better be doing our research, and we ought to be having sessions here where, okay, we're running through these rules to make sure that we're obeying every single one, because otherwise we're in trouble.
If I swallowed this hook, line, and sinker, we're all going to hell. And the angels are not
going
to protect us.
Please don't. I don't want to go to hell with you.
And how are we defining transgressors of law, God's law? Ellen White says in other places the most obnoxious sin in God's sight is our own pride. Mm-hmm. It's not whether we, in this era, in my opinion, whether we circumcise our little boys or whether we have the candles lit the minute the sun sets or the things that we as Adventists have been accused of sheer legalism for. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we could include law abiding to include humility and recognition of our great need of a very gracious and merciful judge and mediator.
So you're going to help me throw this out.
I'm getting there.
You're getting there. Okay. I mean, these are the passages we are recommended to read for this lesson. What are we going to do with them? Yeah. Good.
There have been times in my life that I puzzled over this because I read where if there are any sins unconfessed and unforgiven on our books in heaven, that it won't be good for us. And I would worry. I thought, well, what if I can't remember them all? Am I supposed to sit down and try to remember every single little time I hit my sister or said something nasty to somebody?
Now, that would be tricky.
You know? And go to that person and ask them to forgive me for that and that and that and that. And the explanation that made sense to me was God will remind us if there's something we need to. And if it's the neglect, like it says here, of a known duty or a known, if we knew that we were transgressing or if we knew that, if we know of something that we mm-hmm. are not doing, that is one of God's requirements. Are we willing to surrender self and let God help us do it?
Why do you think that the knowing would be important? Is a sin that I remember more serious than one that I don't remember?
If it's a sin that we know that we should quit doing or we should confess and we refuse, then that's rebellion. If we don't know about it, God will bring it to our remembrance if it's something we need to do.
I mean, simple things like pride and covetousness, those kind of things you mean?
And rebellion.
Okay, and rebellion. Okay. Yeah, got a hand over here. Don?
This is just a thought, and maybe it's way off the wall, but, you know, I was thinking about the situation between Zipporah and Moses, and then Moses being faithful to his commission and his relationship with the Hebrew God. I kind of think, and we talk about being unequally yoked, and of course, he was to deliver Egypt, and it wasn't happening, and Zipporah was, deliver his people from Egypt, and it wasn't happening. Seventh-day Adventists, we have been looking forward to what? The second coming. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't been happening. And maybe we are, in a sense, unequally yoked with people that are living just a Christian experience here, not necessarily focusing on the second coming. And I think of, well, we're warned, you know, about apostate Protestantism, Roman Catholicism, and spiritualism. And maybe we are sometimes unequally yoked in these areas. But I see this also in a larger view. She's telling us here where our real dependency and where most of the loyal are. Mm-hmm. And that's not on earth in the time of trouble. It's the loyal angels that got the right picture of God at the cross.
Well, there are many times in the writings of Ellen White where she talks about one known sin and those kinds of things. And if you put all those quotations together and read them back to back, it's scary. It is very, very scary. Wally.
You know, when I read that, I wonder if it's not a similar situation that at the time of Christ's second coming, are there going to be individuals similar to Job where, you know God so well, or at least you hope you got to that point where you know him and you do the things because you enjoy doing it, not because you have to again. And you've grown to that point to where even in this world, Christ is showing that it is possible to live, so to speak, a perfect life. You through growing in your experience of getting to know him. And just like Job mentioned, he said, yeah, I used to do it in the past, but I don't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Is that really possible to do that in this life?
I don't think God would ask us to do something that he considered to be impossible. John, we've got minus about 2 minutes. You want to say a couple words?
Can I have half of them? Well, okay.
Half of the minus 2 minutes,
just, about this being picky, remember the rocket that went up. I think there were 7 people on board, and there was a little grain of sand somewhere in the ship that nobody knew about, and they all died. That's the way, when we're following God's instructions, we're in an area where we have to be extremely careful. He could have saved that, I suppose he could have saved those people in the rocket by removing that sand before, that grain of sand before they took off. But I'm just saying, it's a very important to follow his instructions because he's the only one that knows how to instruct us to salvation.
So you're saying even a little bit of strychnine isn't good?
Even a little bit is not good. Well, it depends on where it is.
Okay. Don, I'm past time. I got to cut it. I'm sorry. There are lots of things about prejudices. There are things here we didn't get to talk about Zipporah's family. But God here is trying to tell us that Our lives matter. Our relationships matter. How we relate to our in-laws matter. And it's important to God just as it's important to us. Let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, we thank you for these words. Sometimes we don't fully understand all that they mean or all that they imply, but we ask for your guidance for us to walk day by day and not to make those apparently small mistakes that might be perilous to our lives. This is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming.